This broadcast is for information purposes only and should not be regarded as a recommendation or an offer to sell or solicitation of an offer to buy any securities or other instruments mentioned herein. This broadcast is the opinion of Jordan Kimmel and may not reflect the opinion of Brook Street Securities Corporation. At the time of this broadcast, a member of Mr. Kimmel's household owned shares of the company discussed in this program. Brook Street was not making a market in the securities mentioned in this program, but its representatives may deal as agent and or principal in the securities mentioned in this program. Additional information on securities discussed herein available upon request.
This is Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Profitable Investing is the show that will take you through the ever-changing world of investing for a profit. Now, here's the host of Profitable Investing, Jordan Kimmel.
And welcome. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another segment of Profitable Investing with me, your host, Jordan Kimmel. And today we've got a special treat. For the whole hour, you don't need to hear me talk about Magnet and Magnet Investing. We have a special guest. It's legendary Michael Steinhardt. And Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All righty. And let me share, folks, the word legendary is not used a lot, just as a brief background for those not as familiar with what Michael has done. Michael basically had the top track record in the hedge fund business over any considerable length of time. I believe the exact number is Michael turned a dollar into $481 by the time he closed down his multi-billion dollar fund in 1995. What we've talked about, Michael, on the show over and over again is how Magnet has tried to learn from the greatest. We pieced together different aspects of investing, and it's really, really an honor and a pleasure to have you join us.
You're very nice to say that. Thank you.
All righty. So first, let me share, folks. Michael has a book out that he's written called No Bull, My Life in and Out of Markets, a book that I've not only have read, I've taken a bunch of quotes and put them into my permanent quote vocabulary. And Mike went through his childhood, his career in and out of the markets, and what he's done outside the markets, almost as legendary as what he's done inside. But what I want to jump right into to get into the market itself is I'm a big fan of Gerald Loeb, who wrote back then in Battle for Investment Survival that trading experiences increase your decision-making skills. What you've talked about, as opposed to being quantitative or any other way, it's really you developed a feel for the market through your experiences. Why don't you just start by sharing with us how you got into the business and then maybe how your trading experiences made you even a better investor?
Well, I got into the stock market in a most peculiar way. I grew up in a lower middle class neighborhood in Brooklyn called Bensonhurst, and the stock market was extraordinarily far from my life as a child growing up. But my mother and father were divorced when I was a baby, and when it came time for my bar mitzvah, my father showed up, which wasn't a certainty, but he did. And instead of giving me the normal gift, the normal bar mitzvah gift at that time, which was typically a white envelope that had a $10 or a $20 bill or a U.S. savings bond with an ultimate value of $25 or $50, he, having been gambling with a stockbroker, who had persuaded, probably the better word was conned, him into buying shares in two different companies, had these shares, and didn't know what to do with them, so he gave them to me. And they were 100 shares of a company called Pendixy Cement and 100 shares of Columbia Gas, and he, not having the faintest idea about stocks or anything or the stock market, he gave me 100 shares of each of these two companies, and he said, here, this is my bar mitzvah present to you. They're yours. Do what you want with them. And I took them, and their value on his giving them to me was over $5,000, which seemed to me all the money in the world. And it was an astonishing gift, typical of my father, who was extraordinarily generous and extraordinarily unpredictable and a little bit crazy. And that gift changed my life. It refocused my energies. I stopped playing ball in the schoolyard, and I stopped thinking about the things that teenage boys in Brooklyn thought about, and I thought almost entirely about the stock market. And from the age of 13 on, I used to get 3 different editions of the newspaper because I'd get the opening prices and the midday prices and the closing prices, and I used to go downtown to the brokerage offices in downtown Brooklyn. There used to be something called a Bache office or a Merrill Lynch office, and I'd sit there with the old men and the smelly cigars, and I'd watch the ticker tape, and there, at that point, there really was a ticker tape, and it did make noise, and it did move across a screen, and I really learned about the stock market the old-fashioned way. And that's how, by the age of 16, when I was when I graduated from high school, I really had 3 years of experience in the stock market, which very few 16-year-olds could claim at that point. And again, at the age of 16, my father came into my life. I was going to go to the Bernard Baruch School of Business of City College, because I didn't have any money. But he showed up and again asked me what school I was going to, and I said Bernard Baruch City College, because I was, of course, at this point interested in business because of my interest in the stock market. And he shook his head and he said, "I don't want you to go there." And he racked his brain and he said, "There's this other school in Philadelphia," and he couldn't quite think of the name of it. Finally it came to him, and he said, "Yeah, this is a school in Philadelphia, and it's a business school, and it's a, and I know it because I remember seeing in the Sunday section of the New York Times, these rich Jewish boys, marrying seemingly rich Jewish girls who had graduated, the boys anyway, having graduated from this school, and it was called the Wharton School, and that's where I want you to go, and I'll pay." So that's how I went to the Wharton School rather than to the Bernard Baruch School of City College. And I'm not sure that I got a better education necessarily at the Wharton School, but the world was such that if you went to the Wharton School, you had the possibility of getting certain jobs that you couldn't have gotten having gone to City College. So I graduated in 3 years from the Wharton School at the age of 19, and that was the beginning of my career in the stock market. And life is fortuitous. And from the age of 13 through my graduation from Wharton, and through my 20s, and through my 30s, and through my 40s, my entire focus, my vocation and my avocation was the stock market. It was trading and investing and being right.
Right.
And that was the thing, being right, picking the moving parts. It was never being in business and building a business. It was just being right. That was my world, and that's how it started.
Fantastic, fantastic background. What I want to ask you here is a lot of folks, including myself, again, I myself really believe that you learn a lot by trading, and you learn your own emotions, and you learn what you did right and what you did wrong. The emphasis throughout your book really was how you developed this kind of feel for the market, these instincts for the market. I want to ask you also, though, because I always ask everyone at the show and all the people I talk to that they should also read a lot. Can I ask were there any early heroes of yours or any books that meant anything for you, or was it really the feel of trading where you learned, this success level you developed?
For me, it was the repetitive experience of investing and speculating and trading. And when young people ask me what they should do if they want to go into the stock market, I'm not sure it's applicable today. It probably still is. I used to tell them that there are 3 things they should do. Number one, they ideally should spend some time in the world of investment research, because they should learn the intellectual aspects of evaluating securities. And I think that's really helpful.
Excellent.
And I did some part of that,
right.
analyzing companies, visiting managements, looking at balance sheets, looking at income statements, projecting earnings, projecting the competitive positions of companies, that sort of thing. And that's one of the things that one should do. The second thing one should do, in my view, is understanding the way securities are sold, the sales aspect, how people persuade other people to buy and sell stocks, the way people trade stocks, the manner in which brokers and others, the techniques by which people are persuaded that they should buy and sell stocks. I think it's a very important element in understanding the world of security. So the sales aspect of it is important. Mm-hmm. And historically, at least, and perhaps even today, salespeople are the people who make the most money in the securities world. And that's really an important element. And the third aspect, of course, is trading. Because in trading, you're closest to the pulse. You know, that's where fear and greed and all those elements of emotion have to be dealt with and controlled. And that's the element that I think I related to most in some sense. And it takes a long while to control it. When I first started to trade, I was lucky enough to make a lot of mistakes in my teenage years. And the sooner you make mistakes, the better off you are, because you gotta make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta learn only from your own mistakes, because there are certain mistakes that everybody makes, and the sooner you make them, the better off you are. And I didn't learn so much from books, but I learned more from my own misjudgments. And it seems to me that the earlier you do it and the more often you have the opportunity to make judgments. And in a certain sense, when people ask me why I felt I was so good at what I did, it was because I made more judgments by a certain age than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
In my mid-20s, I had traded more stocks and made more judgments. And I don't make judgments in a vacuum. I really applied all the intellect I could to every single judgment I made. And doing that over and over again, in part in a repetitive sense, and in part because every single judgment had new elements. It was in part repetitive, and it was in part new every time. And that conditioning makes you a better investor or trader, however you want to call it.
Right.
And that's why I think when I was in my 30s, I had the experience of a 50-year-old, et cetera, et cetera. So it's that process, that repetitive process, and the ability to have made so many mistakes over a period of time, that after a point you stop making the same mistakes, because you almost intuitively know. You don't know it consciously, you know it subconsciously. There's a book out, which I just started to read, and I'm not 100% sure that that book captures it. It's called Blink.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the intuition you have that allows you to sort of know without even being able to consciously articulate it when you're right and when you're wrong. And I used to sense this when I was in my business. I would see people, I had, as you may know from reading my book, I had at times a terrible reputation for having a fearsome temper because I would sense things that people who were working with me wouldn't quite sense. And I would snap at them because I sensed perhaps more quickly than they did when something wasn't right. And I couldn't even tell them why I felt it. And more often than not all the time, but more often than not, that I was right. It was because of this extended experience that I had that they didn't have.
Right.
And that's hard to communicate. And it's even perhaps hard to communicate to your radio audience, but that's what it's all about.
No, I hear what you're saying. I think it really goes back to what Loeb said, that the trading experience, it's not a matter of paper trading, because it's not the same emotions at stake, not the same, live show, so to speak. So what you're saying, rings very, very clear. It makes a lot of sense to me. And this is why it's so difficult that you're a hard guy maybe to learn from, because it's not all math and it's not all this, it's that. It's trading experience and it's instinct. And what was for you the willingness, I guess, to make mistakes at that early age and trust yourself at that time. Michael, what we're going to do is we're going to take a real quick break. We're going to come back, folks. We have Michael on for the entire show. So with that, Mike, stay with us. You are listening to Voice America Business. I'm Jordan Kimmel. We'll be right back with more profitable investing after this quick break.
At the Magnet Investment Group, our job is to maximize returns for both institutional and individual investors. We have a team of licensed investment professionals who are available to handle all facets of financial planning, insurance, and investing for individual retail accounts. Go online now at magnetinvestment.com and see what we can do to help your financial success. Call right now and never make a bad investment again. 1-973-895-4444. The Magnet Investment Group, a disciplined way to pick winning stocks.
Tune in to Voice America Business every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time for Become a Broker in Less Than 3 Months with Richard Weddington. On the show, you will get an insider's look into the mortgage industry, as well as learn how brokers can earn a good living working from their home with the top lenders in the country. Each week, Richard and his guests will discuss different topics from understanding credit to working with realtors. So tune in and get connected with Richard Weddington and become a broker in less than 3 months. Right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business, this is Voice America Business.
You're logged on to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. If you would like to call in with a question or comment for Jordan or his guests, dial toll-free at 1-888-766-6828. Once again, that number is 1-888-766-6828. Let's get back to another segment of Profitable Investing. Here's Jordan Kimmel.
And welcome back, everybody, to another segment of Profitable Investing. We have Michael Steinhardt still on the show joining us to go over what he's learned, not only in the markets. We're going to get into what he's been able to do for others since he's hung up his trading shoes. But what I want to do is I want to stay on a theme. Michael talked in the first segment about his experience, where it left him there. There's a expression that I wrote down, Michael, from your book called variant perceptions. And I think what I want to talk about is exactly that. There's a matter of following the trends. Momentum investing kind of showed up, got pretty popular over the last few years. But can you share with us what your expression variant perception means and how you applied it and maybe how it helped you being a better investor?
Yes, I was never a momentum investor. I was never a trend-following investor. Just wasn't my thing. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are that way, and they say things like, the trend is your friend, and, follow the Fed, and things like that. And in many respects, those cliches have some real validity to them, but it just wasn't my thing, and I would not play the game that way. I was just, as a person, too ornery and too difficult, and I don't like to use the word contrarian because it's become a cliche as well, but I really like to find approaches that left me in a position against the world left me in a position where I saw everybody moving, everybody, you can never see everybody, but seeing the market moving in a certain direction, and I could find a view that was at variance with that movement, and particularly when I could find a view that I believed in that was at variance with the world at large. And my greatest successes were when I could get intellectual conviction that was at variance with that of a generalized trend. And I talked about some of them in the book. I'd say one of the most pleasing to me was in the early 80s when interest rates were at record levels and inflation seemed to be endemic. And I guess Volcker was chairman of the Fed, and it seemed that there was no end to inflation. Interest rates were at, the funds rate reached 18 or 19%.
Incredible,
and,
yeah.
And oil prices were through the moon, and bonds were called certificates of confiscation and all that sort of stuff. And the economy was fairly strong, and there wasn't even then a sense that these interest rates were yet impacting the economy to the point of creating a recession. And I, at that point, started to buy bonds. And this was the first venture we had in bonds. And it was scary because, number one, I wasn't a bond investor, and number two, it was really counter the world, and we used leverage, and the leverage grew, and I wasn't used to bond leverage because there it was like the Wild West, because with the stock market you were constrained by the margin regulations, which I think at that point was 50%, so you can only do what the Federal Reserve allowed you to do, but with mm-hmm. treasuries you could do whatever you wanted. So you could buy a bond on 90% or 95% leverage, and you really could go and really swing the big bat.
Right.
And I just kept doing it, and the amounts that I had were just at some point really sort of staggering. And what we did at that point is we reported to our investors monthly, and one of my partners said, "Well, don't you think you should report this investment to our investors?" I said, "I guess we better." So I reported the treasury investment, and I emphasized its size, and suddenly our limited partner said, "What are you guys doing? You're crazy." And before too long, when we started to lose, and we lost 1 month and 2 months, and they were really upset. And at the earliest opportunities, some of them began to withdraw, and I try to justify my rationale for being in this investment as best I could. But again, I was an inexperienced bond investor, and the popular wisdom was that interest rates were going up forever, and inflation was a phenomenon that was something that could not be curbed. And the year ended. It was our fiscal year was September. And, I mean, we were up somewhat for that fiscal year, but the bond experience was not, we lost a little bit in bonds. I think we were up a little bit for the year, but what a good year. And some of our most trusted and loyal investors left us, and I really felt crummy. And the new year began, and it was October, and interest rates then started to fall.
Right.
And in the month of October, we made 70% of our money in 1 month.
A nice way to start the new fiscal year.
Ooh, was that a pleasure. And by 2 months into the fiscal year, we were up almost 100%. It was an extraordinary feel. lose money for other people, that sinking feeling is just terrible. And when you really, and when you do it on leverage, you really don't know when and if you're going to be right. And then when it turns, particularly when you're alone and you're doing it and you feel like you're against the world, it's a wonder. On the one hand, it's wonderful. On the other hand, it's terrible. And that's how I've tended to invest. I've tended to like the feeling. I mean, it's just my nature to not be a momentum investor and not to be a sort of person who, you know, who sees a trend forming and
right.
jumps on the trend. That's the way I am. So, Andrew, right. I don't know if that's an answer to your question.
No, it's a great answer, but I want to you know, expand on that, because, you know, I'm not even going to get into the part about the emotional side. What I want to really bring out here is that when you're finding this variant spot, and
so variant perception is to understand where the world is, number one,
right?
To know enough to have a conviction, to at times, because it doesn't happen very often,
right.
to develop a conviction that is at variance with where the world or the market
right.
seems to be, and to have the conviction
right.
to make that bet. And if you can do it once or twice or three times a year, that's ample. And to be right, then you almost always win if your conviction's right. And
right.
it's rare that you can face something
but
like
let's
that
talk
in the
about, but let me interrupt you, talk about this. It's very important.
Yeah.
Because you're not the momentum investor, and the
right.
point is, when you're finding something where you're at odds with the world, usually, at least from the very beginning, by nature, you almost have to be wrong for a little while.
That's right. That's absolutely correct.
So what I want to ask you is, there's so many guys out there who talk about getting stopped out at 5%. And
I don't do stops.
Okay, so this is exactly what I want to bring out. Here's a guy who put up the best numbers of all. Were you also willing to average down?
Yes.
And at what point, maybe, if your conviction stayed true, was there a holding period where you come up and gasp for air or come out of a position? This is the hardest. This is where I'm talking about managing the emotions of it.
Yeah, now sometimes you're not always right. Sometimes you just liquidate because you're wrong, or you acknowledge you're wrong, or you say, I just can't take it anymore.
Right.
I mean, let it be clear, I've been wrong my share of times, but I do average down, or when I'm short. I mean, the worst pain is when you average up on the short side. That is
right.
pure unadulterated pain, and I've done it plenty, but that's what I do.
Right.
And I don't have stop losses. I don't do those sorts of things that are mechanically created to alleviate pain. I like to just suffer.
Well, you suffer as long as you had to. And what I want to share is, you know, when I look at the numbers, what's kind of amazing when you say that is, you know, the number of years up versus down that you had, you really put up some, incredible numbers by anyone's standards. But what you have right now is what I call rule followers. If you're down 5%, you have to sell. You can never, blah, 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 blah. You know, all these kind of rules. Were there any rules that you kind of had? Because I didn't really come across a lot of rules in your book.
Well, yeah. I mean, the rules I tended to focus on, well, the first thing was, and it's not a rule, but there was an intensity in the business that created its own rules, meaning
okay.
at the end of every day, and often very many times each day, I looked at the portfolio and looked at every single stock. So I assumed a certain element of truth and veracity and factuality in the performance.
Mm-hmm.
So if stock one went from 40, if we liked it at 15 and it went to 12, I didn't assume that was a random phenomenon to be ignored. I would say, why did this stock go from 15 to 12 or 15 to 14? What's the matter? What do they know that we don't know? And why has this happened? And explain it to me. And I would analyze and overanalyze and say, you know, we like the stock at 15. I know we're going to like it more at 14 and 13 or 12, but something, they know, why is this stock trading where it is? And I would insist upon the movement of the stock itself saying something that had to be understood by me, mm-hmm. so as to explain my crummy performance. So we really took particularly the negative aspects of our performance very, very seriously.
Right.
So, I mean, a typical example, I used to get woken up in the morning by a dear friend of mine, and he would call me at 6 o'clock and tell me what was happening in Japan and Europe and in the currencies and in all the stocks I had and whatever markets were trading in whatever parts in the world. And he'd tell me six or eight different positions I had, and if six of them were good and one of them was bad, I would just focus on the bad.
Right.
And by the time I was finished, well before the market was open, I had some understanding of why my one crummy position or two crummy positions, or heaven forbid if there were seven crummy positions, I would be miserable before right. the market opened. So it was always operating as if the world were coming apart.
Right.
At my 25th anniversary, we had a party at the Metropolitan Museum, and I started my speech by saying, I haven't had a good day in the market since my bar mitzvah. And that's how it felt.
Right. Well, you are something else. Listen, what we're going to do, we're going to get into a couple other really important subjects and move away from the market, but we're going to stay on the market for a little while. We unfortunately have to take another commercial break, Mike. Stay with us.
Okay.
You are listening to Voice America Business. I'm Jordan Kimmel. We'll be right back with more profitable investing after these messages.
At the Magnet Investment Group, our job is to maximize returns for both institutional and individual investors. We have a team of licensed investment professionals who are available to handle all facets of financial planning, insurance, and investing for individual retail accounts. Go online now at magnetinvestment.com and see what we can do to help your financial success. Call right now and never make a bad investment again. 1-973-895-4444. The Magnet Investment Group, a disciplined way to pick winning stocks.
You hear business show after business show all geared towards improving a company's bottom line. But what about your bottom line? How come no one ever talks about that? Finally, a show dedicated to the worker. The Crow Show with Paul McLaughlin, the Work Wonk. Heard every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, the Crow Show is aimed specifically at the worker and their environment. From work skills and technology to dealing with bosses and coworkers, the Crow Show will give you insight on how to survive and prosper in today's workplace. The Crow Show with Paul McLaughlin, the Work Wonk. Heard every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line of Business Talk, BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business, this is Voice America Business.
Welcome back to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. If you would like to be a caller on the show, dial toll-free at 1-888-766-6828. Now please welcome back the host of Profitable Investing. Here's Jordan Kimmel.
And welcome back, everybody, to another segment of Profitable Investing. And we have the legendary Michael Steinhardt on with us. And I want to jump right into a couple themes, expand on something Michael's talked about. He started by talking about being able to analyze numbers. And, you know, though he's a little shy to mention it, Michael, before he started his hedge fund, was one of the top analysts on Wall Street. And when we talked a minute ago about his ability to average down, I believe personally that's because he wasn't following just charts and following the crowd. If he did the numbers, something was better at 12 than 15. I think that's
Michael, probably why you were able. You knew what the heck you owned.
That's
you
right.
weren't following a chart.
That's right.
Okay.
Or at least I thought I did. It was extraordinarily important for me to feel that I had competitive edges. I mean, when we had our firm parties once a year, my confreres used to put on the T-shirts that were given out the following, because I used to say this all the time, what do you know that the world doesn't know?
Wow.
And that was the theme. What do you know that the world doesn't know?
Yeah. Okay. Now, listen, I want to ask something else. This is really important to me. I've noticed that even the great traders in history, although they were known for their trading, actually made a lot of their money on a few individual ideas, and I know you're different. I know you said in your book that basically you can count the number of stocks that doubled probably on a single hand.
Yeah.
What I want to ask you now is, a few years back, there's been time to reflect. There's an expression about sitting tight and being right. My question is, it's very hard to let that happen. Do you think you could do that now, or would you even want to do it now in a little bit of retrospect?
It's a very good question. I admire those investors who've had the ability to carefully select those companies that are going to be great performers and over a number of years will grow by 3, 6, 8, 10 times, and they just, you know, buy them and put them away. And that has not been a skill of mine. And in some sense, does that make life easy? isn't it wonderful? I mean, you know, I guess you have to say that that's a Buffett skill, or Peter Lynch or somebody like that. I don't know. And you don't have to work as hard as I do. You don't have to come in every day. You don't have to yell and scream. You don't have to focus on the tape. You don't have to have the anxieties that I did for most of my career. So I admire those people who can do it, even though I frankly don't know very many of them, and I don't know any of them who have achieved the gross rates of return that I have.
Right.
I don't know any of them who have.
No.
But, in fairness, with the tax code being what it is, and a considerable portion of my gains having been short-term, and a considerable portion of their gains being long-term, if you adjust for long and short-term, even though my gross returns may have been greater, maybe their net returns may have caught up.
I think that's true in too many cases, but what I want to do now, because the hour is going to come to a close, not too soon, if you want, we could stay on for the last segment too, but I can't really, after reading your book, not spend a little bit of time talking about your father, the influences your father, and you brought out an interesting parallel between gambling, which was something that he loved to do, and investing. And people, you know, shudder when they think of the comparison, but when it comes to both money management and probability, I think these things are very parallel. Maybe you want to spend a couple minutes on that.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think my father was an extraordinarily intelligent man who did not have the benefit of any serious education, but nevertheless, you know, spent so much of his life gambling in anything figuratively that moved, whether it was horse racing or casinos or cards. I mean, you name it, he gambled on it. And, I think in the times I knew him, he clearly lost more than he won. I mean, I remember with great anxiety watching him watch football games that he had bet on, and it was like, God made little green apples in the last quarter of these games, he would invariably lose by the spread. You know, it was unbelievable. I remember once he got so angry, he went over to the television and kicked the receiver in. He got so angry at the thing, you know, because he always lost by the spread. I mean, it was the most phenomenal thing. But he was very intelligent. He applied all the intellectual energy he could to figuring out how to do better. And in some sense, you can't but deny, but acknowledge, rather, that the stock market has elements of probability in it. And there clearly is a parallel in gambling in the stock market. Now, the stock market has, you might, if you're very cynical, you might say, you know, there are all sorts of advantages in the stock market to some people that there aren't in gambling. If you're a professional in the stock market, you have all sorts of advantages that the average guy doesn't have. Mm-hmm. If you get, you know, if you're knowledgeable, you learn things and you see things, in terms of the quality of information and as much as, you know, inside information is something that one, may not have, at the same time, your ability to analyze information is so much better than other people's. I mean, so many issues that give one an advantage in the stock market. I mean, the capitalist system, as much as the government can try to make it a level playing field, it's not a level playing field.
We
all know it's not a level playing field. So, so I don't know how you exactly.
Well, if you were able, for example, like what you're saying, what hits me, if you knew certain players weren't going to play any game, because of injuries, and only you knew that by digging harder, you make money like that. And I guess maybe in companies by going through the balance sheet and doing some things and getting through to management and understanding some of the variant perceptions you had gave you that kind of edge. And by the way, the VIG on sports is a lot bigger than the VIG on trading stocks.
So it
was a lot easier. But, you know, what I also thought about, too, was the money management side. You know, when you feel you're hot, maybe when you press your bets, and when you know maybe you need to take some time off or to lower your exposure. And again, I had a father who liked to gamble as well, and too many people would look at me and say, "This, you know, are you sure you're not gambling or investing?" And I talked about the overlap between them. As long as you weren't doing it for the thrill, ultimately it was to make the most amount of money you could.
Yep.
So what I want to do is we're going to take a break. I'm going to ask you to stay because we didn't get to the very important part, something called Birthright Israel. I know you want to spend a little time on. If I could take a quick commercial break and have you stay on, Michael,
that
would be great. So if you could just stay with us. Folks, you are listening to Voice America Business. I'm Jordan Kim. We'll be right back with Michael Steinhardt following this quick break.
At the Magnet Investment Group, our job is to maximize returns for both institutional and individual investors. We have a team of licensed investment professionals who are available to handle all facets of financial planning, insurance, and investing for individual retail accounts. Go online now at magnetinvestment.com and see what we can do to help your financial success. Call right now and never make a bad investment again. 1-973-895-4444. The Magnet Investment Group, a disciplined way to pick winning stocks.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
You're logged on to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. If you would like to call in with a question or comment for Jordan or his guests, dial toll free at 1-888-766-7233. 1-888-766-6828. Once again, that number is 1-888-766-6828. Let's get back to another segment of Profitable Investing. Here's Jordan Kimmel.
And welcome back, everybody, to a wrap-up session here, Profitable Investing. We've been really lucky, folks. I hope you've listened to the show a few times. Michael Steinhardt really has talked about several things that need to be heard twice to get the depth of them all, and I really appreciate you spending the time.
My pleasure.
What we've done, Mike, we've talked about a lot of really what led to the most profitable track record of anyone I've ever read about, just a tremendous record. But then suddenly in 1995, I know it's the second time you gave up the trading, but this time maybe it's for real. Who knows? Everyone wants you to manage money for them still. But you went on and did some, to me, incredible things outside the market in terms of philanthropy and donations. I want you, if you could, share with us what Birthright Israel is, what it's all about, what it means to you. It really meant a lot to me reading the book.
Well, at some point in my career, I decided that I'd made more money than I knew what to do with, and I kept thinking about what was important to me. And for reasons that are complicated and even hard for me to understand, I decided that my Jewishness was important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's complicated. It's complicated because I'm an atheist. It's complicated because my Jewish education was lousy.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated because while I love Israel, and Israel became a substitute for my Jewish religious education, somehow I felt intensely Jewish in a variety of ways, and I decided that which I might be able to do, which I might feel good about, was somehow to try to devote my life to the idea of reversing the decline in the non-Orthodox Jewish diaspora, which I felt and feel is falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I devote my energies. And Birthright Israel is one program toward that goal. In other words, people who live in the United States who are Jewish and not Orthodox are slowly fading away from our religion. They care less. It's easy to become involved in America. America's a wonderful place, and to become more American and less Jewish, to marry outside the religion, to show up less in synagogues, to be less involved in Jewish events, and that's sort of what's happening. So I've devoted myself to things like Hillel's and Jewish education, and what Birthright is a program that offers every Jew outside of Israel between the ages of 18 and 26 the opportunity of a free trip to Israel for 10 days, anyone who hasn't been there. And it's been a wonderful program. We started 6 years ago now. And about 90,000 young people have gone on it. And it's really changed a lot of lives and shown them somehow that Israel connects very easily with these people in the diaspora, and it's revitalized their interest in Judaism in many cases, and it's been for a lot of people had the ability to enable them to relate to their heritage in ways that perhaps they wouldn't have otherwise.
Right. You know, towards the end of the book, you talk about a speech you gave, and you know, one of the gentlemen came up with you and you know, just shared how meaningful and how grateful he was to have that. And what I said to myself at that moment is I'm sure that one comment had to be better than any single trade. Maybe except, you know, maybe not that bond trade, maybe not a dollar into 481, but it's these kind of things where I've said the same thing, where there's only so much you can eat and so much you can spend. Giving back is so critical. Maybe, you know, I know you're a humble guy. Maybe you want to talk about a couple other things that you've seen a cause or seen a need and has shared some of the tremendous wealth you generated by helping others?
Well, it's not, I don't think so much about giving back. That's a phrase I feel is overused. What I think about is to, you know, I have enough money for my life and my kids' life and their kids' life, and I think about what to do with it that I'll feel good about.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very radical statement, and it's probably one I won't have the courage to achieve, but in a theoretical sense, I'd like to die broke. I'd like to have given away all my money
mm-hmm.
to things that really matter to me. And if I can do that and do it with things that I feel good about, then I think I will have lived a good life. And that's my final thoughts for the day, I
okay.
think.
Okay. Well, let me just share, you know, one thing. I'll tell you the quote that I wrote down mm-hmm. for myself from your book, which I've absolutely loved. You know, one of the things where you put down was, rarely does a mix of overconfidence, science fiction, and new but demonstrative wealth lead to continued success as a money manager. I love that. You know, it's a matter of staying humble, you know, maybe not reading your own press clips, you know, all that much. But I will share with you, you've led a path and created a standard, I should say, for other money managers, which, you know, we're all trying to live up to. I know the question you're asked more than anything else is, Michael, come on, why don't you come back in, and why don't you do it again? But we'll leave that to you, okay?
Yes, sir.
It's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Thank you,
I appreciate
sir.
It. And then if you want to just, I'll catch up with you down the road. I'll spend a couple minutes to wrap up the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure, Jordan. Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Folks, what you just listened to is virtually a legend in our business. Mr. Steinhardt put up a track record like nobody else ever has, and in his humble way is giving away a significant piece of his net worth to various causes. Things I want to talk about here just in terms of wrapping up what I think you need to think about. Michael started out as an analyst professionally. He was all about the balance sheet, all about the accounting, and we touched on that during the conversation, that it was a matter of understanding what he actually owned and wasn't influenced, A, by other people, and B, if the chart went against him. Fabulous things to learn and to understand, and the whole idea of being willing to own things against what the public liked. He didn't want to use the phrase contrarian, but folks, that's what it is. It was contrarian. Obviously, Michael, with that kind of track record, what we didn't get to talk about, if you're buying things that nobody likes that tend to go up within a short period of time, there had to be a catalyst to really make that security turn around and work the way it should. So maybe if Michael joins us again, we could talk about how you find a catalyst and what you look for. But what we just had on was probably the single most profitable, most successful hedge fund manager in the history of the United States, who hung up his cleats on a high note, liquidated his fund, and gave the money back to investors, staggering amounts for most. So I want to, number one, thank you all for joining us. Next week, we're going to have Dave Koninger on. He's the CFO of Radiation Therapy Services, another highly ranked magnet stock. We could talk about the management and all kinds of things with him. In the meantime, we've had a drop of a turbulent week. We talked about this even coming into the week, but once again, we're in a very strong bull market, folks. I want you to stay focused, stay profitable, and I want to thank you for joining me on Profitable Investing. Have a great profitable week. See you same time next week. Jordan Kimmel signing off.
Voice America Business would like to thank you for logging on to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Tune in each and every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for another exciting hour of profitable investing, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.